And on the telephone with me from Ithaca, I have James and Claire, and we'll be talking this morning about James Greenwood and an incident that took place in Ithaca.
Sean Greenwood.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sean Greenwood. By getting a little nervous. go right ahead, James. Would you like to start out and explain who Sean Greenwood is?
Certainly. Sean Greenwood was a young black man in Ithaca, with a bit of a troubled background. I didn't know him personally until this case had taken place, or this incident had taken place. It's interesting that you even ask that, like who Sean Greenwood is, because you get so opposing views and versions of who this kid was, depending on if you read the paper and if you speak to people that knew him. He was a young black man that I said that had a troubled past. He was in and out of the penitentiary. He had a child and a girlfriend. He was working. He was trying to get in school. He was struggling. He was a struggling young man, but he seemed to be tacking toward trying to correct his life after having made some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to read this. It's from the Friends, the Ithaca Monthly Meeting of the Religious Friends, the Quakers in Ithaca. Okay, it's from a recent article that kind of encapsulates what happened. It says, in February 2010, at Pete's Convenience Liquor Store, Sean Greenwood, a young black Ithacan, was shot to death by Brian Bang, a young white Ithaca police officer. In July 2010, Brian Bangs was exonerated of any use of excessive force, and a couple of nights after, his home was set on fire. A call went out from and to the religious leaders of the community to come together in prayer for our community, and dozens of people have continued to meet monthly over the last year in a group called Healing Ithaca.
I'm sorry, James, and the person whose house was set on fire, that was Officer Bangs, correct?
Officer Bangs' house was set on fire shortly after he was exonerated of any excessive use of power.
Okay.
Okay? So after Sean Greenwood had been killed, when Brian Bangs was exonerated, it was perceived as a reaction against that decision that his house was set on fire, and I emphasize perceived.
Mm-hmm.
The gatherings of Healing Ithaca have taken place at different places of worship each month. Though a year has passed since the arson, it remains an unsolved crime. A group called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee has examined the findings of the independent investigation into the events surrounding Sean Greenwood's death, and in public meetings have called into question the investigators' conclusions, which exonerated Brian Bang. The issue simmers in our community. There is no resolution and no peace. They go on to say, I believe that the Friends have more than hospitality to offer at their meeting place, and they hope that many will come to the meeting and contribute to this call to the Spirit to guide us. But that's pretty well encapsulates, you know, what the whole controversy is about.
Could you just describe a little bit the difference between the Truth and Reconciliation Group and the Healing Ithaca Group?
Okay. Healing Ithaca. Oh, excuse me. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Claire. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, good. Just to intersperse this. So the Healing Ithaca group formed right after the fire, and I should say the fire happened, I believe it was July 14th, 2010. That was almost 2 weeks after the Brian Bangs was exonerated by the grand jury, or at least they came back to say that there was no grounds for criminal proceedings in that event. In any case, the Healing Ithaca group started to meet right after the fire in sort of an attempt to, for healing. For healing in Ithaca in response to the tensions that the fire would, lead somebody to believe we're getting out of control. The group of us calling ourselves Healing Ithaca that are we're called Truth and Reconciliation, and we are like a subcommittee of Healing Ithaca, but we actually began to meet before Healing Ithaca. We began to meet immediately after the report was published in our local paper. The report by Special Prosecutor Whedon Wetmore about Sean's fatal killing. So that report, or some part of that report, was published in the Ithaca Journal, and we found it really troubling. Once we read that report, we were even more troubled than before reading the report. So we began to meet about what to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Healing Ithaca started, we went to Healing Ithaca. We were very grateful for that initiative. And some of us are totally rooted in the tradition of prayer. And so we very naturally went to that group and continued to go to that group and bring a piece that we felt was important to add to the work of that group, which was to investigate the truth around the killing of Sean Greenwood.
So part of the controversy is that the use of lethal force is in question of whether or not that was necessary in this case. Is that correct?
Yes. So, and James probably has the newspaper reports in front of him, but the day that Sean was killed, I'll just say for myself, I looked out my window. I live on the west side of town, and I could see, I didn't see the shooting happen in that moment, but I saw immediately after the police formation right around Pete's parking lot, and I noted that something very serious had just happened, something really bad had just happened, and others in the room said, well, there must have been an accident, and I said, no, something really bad just happened, because the police are showing their force right now and their power, and indeed there, the reports in the newspapers the following two or three days gave the findings from the police from that afternoon at Pete, and they sort of varied every day. So the point, as you say, Pete, is whether or not lethal force was justified,
mm-hmm.
whether it was legally justified, and knowing that the police and the Ithaca Journal, the newspaper, tell us the key point that makes it justified for Officer Bangs to fatally shoot Sean is that Sean's van was moving forward. So Sean was unarmed; he did not have a gun, but when the officers approached Sean's van to serve him the search warrant, he did not comply and put his hands up in the air. Now, they tased him, and there are many questions in the community about the effect of being tased. The report says that the taser didn't go into penetrate Sean's skin, but there's some questions, doubt about that. But in any case, Sean Greenwood's van lurched forward after that tasing, and it's questionable about how and why, but anyway, the report and the police version is that the van lurched forward and that there was an undercover policeman who was not supposed to be in front of his van, but just suddenly found himself in front of Sean's van as it was lurching forward. So here's the key part right in here, is that Sergeant Brian Bangs believed that he had to shoot Sean Greenwood to save the life of the officer that found himself in front of Sean Greenwood's van. Now, the Ithaca Journal reported various sequences saying that Sean's van moved forward and then back. Sean Greenwood's van hit Sergeant Whitsett, the plainclothes officer that was alleged to be in front of his van, and then went back and then read forward again. These are reports or versions that were published in the Ithaca Journal just the next day, two and 3 days after Sean was killed. Enough to raise some concern about, well, how exactly did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
So, in any case, just in a general sort of way, the Ithacans were led to believe that this was a tragic shooting, but that it was necessary to save the life of a police officer who was in danger of being run over by Sean's van lurching forward. When you read this report published by Whedon Wetmore, the special prosecutor, you read that in addition to to Sean Greenwood being shot by Brian Bangs right at the curb where his van was lurching forward, endangering the life of the officer alleged to be in front of the van, that Brian Bangs shoots Sean again later when Sean's van is about 30 feet up toward a tree and has come to a stop. So in the report, it says that this officer, the plainclothes officer, was hit by the van, by Sean's van, but that he moves out of the way, and the van continues forward to what would be about 2.5 car lengths ahead up to the liquor store, and it turns toward the right, which is heading towards Seneca Street. And it comes to a complete stop with its front right tire disabled at a tree. Like, it hits the tree, the tire is disabled, it's at a complete stop, the engine is revving, but the car is at a complete stop. Brian Bang very notably runs, and is the only officer to do this, runs from the curb up that to that site where Sean's van stops, and positions himself, according to his testimony, Brian Bang's testimony, at the rear view mirror on the driver's side of the car. And it's there that he delivers his final shot to Sean Greenwood. And the coroner report tells us that there are two sets of shots. There's three shots. And the first set of shots that were delivered when Sean's van was at the curb before it goes forward, those shots were probably the one that go into Sean's abdomen, and they don't kill Sean. But the fatal shots actually go into Sean's heart and kill him, and they are said to have been shot, delivered sort of through his heart from the side. They go from the back to the from the left to the right, and the back to the front, and that shot to Sean's heart kill him. So what was very, very disturbing and chilling to us was that, oh, there was actually a second set of shots, and that this wasn't all about saving the life of an officer alleged to be in front of Sean's van, that there was actually another moment, and that Sean's life could have been spared, that we could have had a day, he could have had a day in court, but in the end, Brian Bangs got to be the judge, jury, and executioner of Sean Greenwood as his car sat immobilized next to the tree beside Pete's Liquor Store. So that's a very troubling.
Was there any explanation of or justification for the second set of shots from the defense for Brian Bangs?
Yes.
Claire, do you want to handle that? Because I do know what Sean Green, I mean, what Ryan Baines, content. He claimed that after he pursued the vehicle and it was immobilized, when he ran up to the rearview mirror on the driver's side, he felt that at that point, Sean Greenwood could somehow turn his vehicle violently to the left and pin him between the vehicle and the wall of the liquor store, which was 3 to 4 feet behind him. But it's incidentally a position that he had just run to put himself in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only that. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead, James. Sorry.
It's not only that that's so disturbing here. There are a couple of things involved. Number one, the complete unbelievable scenario that they contend that he had somehow turned his vehicle into a weapon, which is necessary in order to use lethal force. The a person that is being dealt with has to have turned, have a weapon or somehow threaten the public or the officers making the arrest. That is such a troubling sequence, and we can go through it step by step. But to me, the overriding concerning factor is that this is the relationship between the man, the police officer, and Sean Greenwood is a personal relationship. They have had an adversarial, they have been in conflict since high school, and I'll read directly from a discrepancy report that was put out by our committee.
Mm-hmm.
It says, Sergeant Brian Banks was appointed the leader of this group of 11 police officers. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is common knowledge in the community, and we believe in the Ithaca Police Department administration, that there was, since high school years, a very serious grudge, severe animosity between Brian Banks and Sean Greenwood. We demand to know the specific procedure resulting in Brian Banks being appointed as the leader of the tactical deployment.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, he put himself with 11 officers available closest to Sean Greenwood, and his designation was weapon ready to use if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I find this such an obvious conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's disturbing that I have to wonder what questions Wheaton Wetmore was asking Brian Banks to exonerate him. And perhaps there are some circumstances that made this situation one that had to take place like it was. There were no other officers available. Nobody knew that Banks and Greenwood had this adversary relationship. But we're not asking to harass Brian Banks or to dredge up, you know, painful memories for the city. But these are questions that need to be addressed. And it's obvious there's a polarization
mm-hmm.
that's taking place in Ithaca. There were questions asked at the Southside Community Center, which is primarily in the black. It's a mixed neighborhood, but it's the most diverse in Ithaca, I believe. And they asked so many pertinent questions concerning this. And at the time, there was a grand jury investigation about to take place, and they were delayed. The answers they were told couldn't be brought forth at that time. There was an investigation taking place, and that there would be full disclosure and transparency, you know, at some point over the rainbow. And after these findings had come to exonerate Brian Banks, and I mean, these people were calling for Brian Banks to be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
They knew about the relationship. they were asking, why was this guy put in charge of this tactical detail? They have a very toxic relationship. So many questions were asked at that center that were just dismissed, and it's insulting. It's insulting, I believe, to the black community, the way that these questions were dismissed. I mean, very, very pertinent questions, vital questions that needed to be answered for a community to be healed, if we're really talking about a community being healed, and transparent. You know, I find it, and I don't want to get off the subject too far, but I find it disturbing, the deference that the authorities seem to always show to the marshal, the military component of our society. We try so hard to vindicate them, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. I saw on television the other day a policeman drag a kid down a driveway or an alleyway and slam his head into to his window. He was handcuffed, and when they reported it on, and they showed it on TV, and they were saying the alleged assault or the alleged abuse, you know. There are so many cases that, and I'm sorry, I'm getting a little off the subject, but it is disturbing to me. And there was explain really quickly. There was a gentleman in this community that wrote an article saying to the community in general that this is nothing that we should be surprised at. This is something that takes place daily in this country. There's Oscar Grant in California, shot while being he was immobilized. He was apprehended. He was handcuffed and thrown on the ground and shot and killed by a police officer. And the officer's reason or excuse was that he thought he had his taser in his hand instead of his pistol. And my question is, why would you taser a young man handcuffed and prone on the ground in the first place? I believe he received a year.
The police officer. The police officer received a year?
Mm-hmm. Yes, for killing Oscar Grant when he was in police custody. In police custody. And I mean, I can go on and on. I mean, you know, back past Vietnam, it's just the tenor of this country to protect their gatekeepers, the military and the police, the military that keeps all the confusion or the, I don't know, the violence that it seems that mid-America or middle-class America seems to fear, that these people will protect us from that, and it has really gone too far. It's not like these guys are Andy of Mayberry. You know, they're not the officers, at least perceived in the black community, they're perceived as an occupation force. Mm-hmm. And whenever black people are killed, they're almost described in the paper as like enemy combatants. The correlation is troubling to me. And sorry, I went off the point there.
I just wanted to mention to what you guys are saying. I was at a town board meeting the other night, and they were talking about whether or not a fence would be permitted. And the fence was for one of the town board members' mothers, and he recused himself of the vote because he thought it would be improper for him to vote on this. And that just brings me to Brian Bangs. Why wouldn't he recuse himself from a situation like this, from being the lead person, when he has, such history with Sean Greenwood?
And Pete, let me interject really quickly, because when I heard about this history, you know, we tried to find out how factual it was, how involved it was, whether it was something that was like on the periphery or, you know, something really right up front. and we got a lot of different opinions. People that said they witnessed them fight, people that said it didn't happen, people that knew them in high school that were describing conflicts they had in high school. And it gets to this point. This is the Truth and Reconciliation Committee is asking for nothing but an independent investigation into the matter. There are so many conflicting and absent witness testimony has been absent. You know, this thing is it's just a small place. It's causing a lot of tension in the community, and it would seem that you know, if there was some possible reason that this man was put at the head of the detail. This man that was the only officer of 11 policemen there to shoot Sean Greenwood, chase his car, and shoot him again. Now, there was another officer with that designation. Only two had the designation firearm at the ready to use this if necessary, and during this whole thing, he never fired a shot. There were 10 other or 9 other officers there with pistols. And if I'm sure if the situation got dire enough, they would discharge their weapons. And even that's a whole other thing. This was in a parking lot, a couple of blocks away from a school with kids in the parking lot. And, you know, we'll get into why did they execute the warrant at that particular time, in that particular place. When they had Sean Greenwood, they said that they had probable cause to issue the warrant because they have two controlled bars by a police investigator. He could have been violated at his parole office. You know, he could have been violated, but they put such a vague explanation about Tompkins County doesn't generally Tompkins County won't prosecute with just witness-controlled by. They want to do a by bust, catch the person with the drugs on them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is general policy. And I'm saying when you have a guy pulling into a parking lot between 4:30 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, after school is out, it's time to, you know, terminate that operation and set it up. If the guy's a drug dealer, he'll be dealing drugs in a couple of days, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had two controlled bars. He hadn't been out of prison a year, according to the information I read. And if they allegedly had two controlled bars, and maybe they really didn't. I don't know why they didn't just use that to violate him and put him back in prison without risking the population. The other officers were at risk, and the warrant, it could have been served at the car at his premises, but yeah, they decided to do it, you know, cowboy style, I say it, down at Pete's mm-hmm. drugstore.
I don't know if we talked about this yet, but the reason that the police were coming after him was for selling cocaine in the store parking lot, correct?
Right. He had allegedly made two previous buys or sales, and observed by a police officer or involving the police officer, and they said that was probable cause to serve him for a warrant. And there was something arranged. They said they had information that a sale was to take place in that parking lot that day. Okay, they proceeded, you know, they set up their tactical unit and deployed them. They had someone observe him come into the lot to make sure, and this is after the fact, to say that if someone had been with them, they would have terminated the operation, which, you know, makes them sound very considerate, which is good if that was actually the case. But, you know, I can't understand taking all of those precautions and then opening up, shooting a .40 caliber pistol numerous times with people were all over. My son was on the phone with me when this happened. He was on his way to the gym, and he said, "Daddy, they just shot somebody at Pete." And I said, "Get out of here." He said, and they tased him first. I saw the sparks from the taser. He was tased three times. Three times he was tased, and they say that he wasn't affected. But when Brian Bang shot him two times with a .40 caliber pistol, he says he saw no reaction. Now, I don't know how somebody can be conscious and shot twice with a .40 caliber and not have a reaction. I'm saying possibly he was already unconscious from being tased three times.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly his foot, after being rigid and into that muscle contraction that the tasers send the body into, his foot could have pushed down on the accelerator. They tased him while he was behind the wheel of a moving car, mm-hmm. and then shot him because they said the car moved toward an officer who found himself. What the hell does that mean? You're on a detail. This officer was supposed to be protecting the people in the store to keep them from coming out and getting into the fray. And then he found himself in front of the car. I don't know what that means. I don't know how you're supposed to be keeping people in the store and you found yourself in front of the car, conveniently creating the circumstances that now the car is a lethal weapon and now this man has to be shot.
Yeah.
Now,
if I could jump...
Go ahead.
Sorry. If I could jump in for a minute, I think what... So, James, I think everything that you said from way back, just to say, was to the point, very much to the point. And I think there are so many layers to this, and what James is saying is just like was a fraction of what was raised at the Southside Community Forum, and that these kinds of things, when an officer, when anybody in the government, public servant kills a citizen, a community member, it's like a thing of the utmost seriousness and importance for us to attend to that matter. And so the people did come out with great concern. Now, very notably, a lot of people didn't, because they believed that what the paper described as a drug dealer and a black man who has been in prison before, and this was an inevitable thing when he was about to kill an officer, and so it was kind of like a tragic thing, but very necessary, and let's move on with life. So depending on where you stand, what your life is like, you have questions or you have just a sense that something tragic occurred, now let's move on. In fact, many Ithacans would say, and it's even written in the paper, the lesson here is that you should always comply with what police tell you to do. Now, where I'm coming from is that it would be the utmost of irresponsible citizenship to leave all matters of life and death in the hands of the beloved men and women that put on the uniform as police people to do that work. That historically is not where all of our peace and security come from, and that the work of maintaining a healthy community is all of our work, and the work of questioning the events surrounding the use of lethal force in our name is our work too. And when the police, when we have a special prosecutor, Whedon Wetmore, that brings the findings of his investigation to a grand jury, and they come back and they say there's no grounds for criminal proceedings against the officer who fired the lethal shots, it is not case closed. We read this report and we see that all those questions that were raised at the Southside Community Forum by the community members who are living most closely in Sean's footsteps, those questions are not answered. And James is asking some of the ones that are still unanswered, like, why is he put ahead of that tactical plan if he has such an obvious conflict with Brian Banks has such an obvious conflict with Sean Greenwood. Why? That question was never answered. And why is he the only one to use his gun and fire the lethal shots? And then what is, did happen to the video? Why can we never see the video from the Pete's parking lot that captures at least some of this event on video footage? And then really troubling to me is that the actual second round of shots, that probably the ones that killed Bryant, that killed Sean, that those are shot not in response to the light, to save the life of an officer in front of Sean's van, but for another reason, and that there is, they give a reason for that, which we didn't even fully give you there, Pete, but that the Ithaca Journal doesn't even talk about that, and to this day, a year and a half after Sean was killed, the Ithaca Journal still characterizes the entire event as a failed shooting to save the life of an officer. And that is not what we read in the report. But something we haven't even brought up yet is that there are witnesses that were right there within feet of this fatal shooting that say that that officer, the plainclothes officer who was alleged to be in front of the van, was never in front of the van. And so that witness testimony, we asked that witness, well, why that did you talk to the police and give them that testimony that you, of what you saw? And that witness said, yes, I did. And yet that testimony does not appear in the report issued by Special Prosecutor Whedon Wetmore. So we have really troubling questions that remain unanswered, and historically we know that it is not the police that we look to for the truth when they are found delivering lethal force, and that if we deny the historical context, that we are very intentionally living in denial. And so we believe that it is our work when lethal force is being delivered in our name, used in our name, to kill people here in Ithaca or anywhere, that it's our work to ask some deeper questions, and that healing does not come simply from accepting the version of the people who did the shooting, but to actually consider the perspective of those people who not only were on the receiving end of the shots at that moment, but historically have been on the receiving end of lethal force and police violence. So that must be said in the context in this conversation.
Was there any other evidence that was omitted besides the testimony of some individuals?
Go ahead, Claire.
It's actually totally time for me to be quiet. Sorry. James.
It was obvious that the when you say was anything else omitted, they presented the scene or exactly what the components were of this whole thing. They showed Sean Greenwood in such a negative light. They went into his history about being arrested and the number of times, and he had ran one time. He was in a car chase at one point. Nothing, I guess it wasn't pertinent to the point they were trying to make, but nothing about the achievements and the striving that he was trying to do, that he was working every day, that he was registering to try to go to, I believe, PC3 or some community college around here. They just focused on the negative, but the most, to me, especially with him being killed, the most important fact was this possible adversarial relationship that had taken place. And that was completely discarded. It was brought up at the Southside Center a number of times. They were asking, what kind of procedure did they have to put him there? Was he ever rescued, I believe the word was? Was he ever rescued from being put at the head and, you know, went into the supervisors? Did they have information? But none of that was brought up, and believe now from somebody there that they were told that they were concentrating on what happened in that parking lot. But that's not true. When you start talking about his history, and that's setting him up, he's coming in there carrying baggage. But Brian Banks didn't have to carry the baggage that I got problems with this kid. And I'm sitting here right next to him. He's in legal gray area here. And honestly, I just believe from reading it, and I don't know, but it needs to be investigated. I feel as though that this boy was killed for personal reasons, and a police operation was used to cover it, and not very well. Not very well.
And was there any type of surveillance that could possibly explain what had happened that day? Any video surveillance in the parking lot?
Confiscated. And also, as I read in the paper, any businesses in the area that could have gotten shots of the parking lot, video confiscated, can't see it. You know, which I'm saying, if it vindicates them, show it. There's tension here. There's suspicion. Show the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And let me add also, I said the other day that they say the tapes show nothing. I'm sure by now they don't. I'm sure they don't show anything by now. But they should have been made available in a timely manner if truly they supported what the police were saying. I mean, why not show it? If it's back in my story, why don't I show it? Common sense. It just makes me suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll come up with a tape so expertly doctored that even, you know, that it'll pass. But I'm wondering how they can retrieve that little indiscretion. And this is from the Southside Center, Pete. Let me just hit this right quick. The belief that if Brian Banks is not prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, it is another violation of constitutional rights as it deals with unreasonable search and seizure. The belief that there is a difference between how citizens are treated in cases like these and how the police are treated. A notation of the statement that Sergeant Banks made regarding the significance of the number of stripes on his uniform, reference to how many people he has killed. The belief that there's an earlier altercation between Mr. Greenwood and Sergeant Banks. And if the administration supports Sergeant Banks, everyone is to blame. The belief that Sergeant Banks is not above the law because of his badge. Now, this was brought out to the, I believe, the district attorney and the police chief. Claire, you were there. I don't know who was at that meeting. But these were serious questions. And they were told they would be answered in a timely fashion. And then other community that doesn't have much to do with where this took place, it was decided that there were no charges would be filed and there was no need for any further investigation. And I find that troubling. You know, I do. I find that very troubling. It seems as though a large segment of this community has been just disregarded. Just disregarded. Like, that's it. The case is closed. Let's move on.
Well, where are things going from here?
Well, we're trying to initiate an independent investigation. We have, we've been meeting. We've been trying to connect with other groups in Ithaca. We're part of the Healing Ithaca, which is religious leaders from all over Cornell University, all different neighborhoods. We're basically, the thing we're trying to do is to get an independent investigation started. And I know it sounds like, you know, it's just repetitive, but we need an independent investigation. Not by the New York State Police, not the same state police that doctored up the Shirley King case. And let me not say the state police. It was an investigator named David Hardy. You know, he provided false evidence in a a murder case here, a tragic case where four people were brutally murdered, and her son was accused of doing it. They were trying to connect Shirley King with this case because apparently the son had some credit cards, and they went on a buying spree, a shopping spree, which is not something somebody I would think would do after committing a crime of that magnitude. But this officer, believing that they were guilty, whatever his motivations were, he provided false evidence, and he was exposed when he went to get a job at the CIA. In the interview, somehow this came out that he had fabricated evidence. Shirley King was in jail because people believed what the state police investigators said in court. She was in jail 2 years. And then when this guy goes to try to get a job with the CIA, I don't know if he was trying to show he was a team player or what, but he informed them that, yeah, he fabricated this evidence. He was arrested, and it was found out that he had fabricated evidence in a number of cases. I'm trying to at least, okay, wait a minute, pleading guilty to four counts of first degree. Four counts of first degree of perjury. Harding faced a sentence of at least four, but not more than 12 years in prison. Okay? So it's not like this was an anomaly. This was this guy's practice. If they didn't quite have the evidence they needed to back up the official version, fabricate the evidence. And he got caught. And I'm saying these are the people that they want us now to say, okay, go ahead and investigate yourself, and we won't be suspicious when you vindicate yourself eventually, which we know is going to happen. I mean, I wouldn't, I certainly would vindicate myself. I'm a human being. I would if I could. But
The analogy that comes to me is like having, for the police to be the only ones to gather, not just, you know, the police and then the special prosecutor who works with the same sort of government agencies, even though he's in a different county, but for them to be the only ones that can gather the evidence and guard the evidence is like having the fox guard the chicken coop in this situation. And so when James says, you know, of course they're going to vindicate themselves, that is sort of being more than foolhardy to just accept everything that's said out of hand. So the two things that we're pursuing now, as James is saying, we're pursuing an independent investigation. We would like the Federal Justice Department to conduct an independent investigation. That's a very hard thing to get, but we'd like to pursue that, or we are pursuing that. It's a very lengthy process. And then we're also told that we can ask the State Inspector General to conduct an investigation of the investigation that was conducted by Weed and Wetmore. And specifically because, for instance, this one witness testimony is left out of the report, what else is troubling there about that investigation? And so those are two things just by way of redressing grievance. But it seems that a lot of our work has also been to simply continually tell parts of the story that are left out of by the police and left out by the paper and left out by the sort of dominant culture in Ithaca, that would just believe that this was a regrettable thing that we must move on from and agree to that we all should like each other. We believe our work is to address also some of the systemic things that give rise to this, and it's work that many people are doing in Ithaca, but specifically around the use of lethal force. We are concerned about the police in our community. Now we have, just a month ago, another young black man killed by police, and immediately we see a contrast between the what the police are telling us and what the human story is behind that official version by the police. And then last winter, another fatality where young black youth were driving in a car, and the car ended up crashing after a high-speed chase by the police, where the police said they stopped chasing that car at the city line, and yet the surviving youth, the two people who survived that that chase, and there were four youth in the car, say that the police were on their tail to the very end, and that actually when the two survivors crawled out of the car after the car crashed, the police were there to greet them with a kind of TV version of hands on your head, treating them like criminals instead of injury victims of a serious car crash. And so the version by the youth is very different from what the police told us. And anyway, it's an ongoing thing in our community that we feel we need to attend to, and just keeping our ears open to the ground of what is happening on the ground on certain sides of the street is part of our work.
Sorry, if I may interject quickly, what Claire just said just brought to light, you know, such a double standard that, man, I'm sitting here spinning around in a circle in one spot, that all of these questionable deaths at the hands of police were handled so obviously with the weight leaning toward their innocence. And just recently, a man that I would bet my hand that you could take my hand if I'm wrong, a man was executed in Georgia with so many questionable circumstances. And we had a vigil up here, and I'm talking about Troy Davis. We had a vigil for him standing in Ithaca at the library. We were just holding pictures, asking people to call, and a police officer stopped and looked at us. He was stopped at a stop sign. As he pulled off, he yelled something that I could not make out exactly what he said, and he could have been saying, good work, keep up, call, and I hope that he's vindicated, but I don't think from his tone that he was encouraging us. He seemed very upset, and he almost took it personally, because an officer was killed in Georgia. And I mean, okay, I can understand the emotional effect it would have on a police officer. You know, his brother officer had been slain on off-duty in a Burger King or McDonald's or something, breaking up a fight, and he probably really thinks that Troy Davis did it. I don't know if he does or not, with seven of the nine witnesses recanting their testimony, but there was such a steady push to put him in that damn cross they put him in before they shoot that, inject him with those chemicals to kill him. And I must add, and this is just for him, I saw so many people around him that looked like they were excited out of their heads. He was so calm, so graceful in the midst of all of that activity. It was hard for me to comprehend, and I was proud of him. I don't know him, but I was proud of him at the way that he had to transition out of this life. The venom, the aggravation and animosity that people felt, even in the question of such very shaky evidence, you know, very shaky evidence, and people from all over the world calling for some refrain and reflection. It was basically that a police officer had been killed, and they were pushing to get their pound of flesh. And I believe it was so obvious that they murdered an innocent man, and life goes on. He was, I saw the thing came across my TV on the bottom, that little stream that runs across. Cop killer, convicted cop killer, Troy Davis, executed in Georgia, period. That's not it.
Oh, my God.
That's not it. That's not the period. You know, people saw, you know, this administration, this martial aspect that we protect and coddle, and it seems like we're afraid. I know people in our Truth and Reconciliation Committee and groups that we have had that are fearful about asking for the truth, that we want to see the video. We think that there's something stinks here, and we want to get it out and get rid of it, and we need to expose it first. They are fearful, and I find that interesting. How are we afraid of those who are supposed to serve and protect? Something is not, something there is oxymoronic or ironic or something, but something doesn't set right. These are our servers and protectors. And people were talking today about whether or not to use your name when you speak on the radio. Fear of retribution.
Mm-hmm.
And these are our servers and protectors. And it's real. It's nothing. It's like nothing. Some paranoia or something like that. It's a serious concern. If they think you're problematic, you can have problems.
Well, we have migrated into the 9 o'clock hour. I thank you both. I think you did a very thorough job explaining. And if more things develop in this and there's a further investigation, keep me updated, and you can come back and we'll talk about it some more.
Thank you so much, Pete.
Thank you.
Have a good morning.
You too.
All right, you too.
Bye now.